and welcome to the Humanising Health and Care podcast, brought to you by The Point of Care. In this episode, Katie Campion, our previous patient experience lead, talks to Bex and Howard about the importance of building relationships in care settings and how quickly these relationships can be built or broken. Thank you for downloading, and we hope you enjoy.
So before we get started, can I ask you both just to briefly introduce yourselves?
My name's Hal Pescott and I'm an Associate Director of Quality and Safety in Sussex Community NHS Foundation Trust. And my background is I'm a nurse and health visitor and worked in public health. So really understanding what our communities need, but also the difference within our communities, been really important throughout my whole career, really listening to people and starting from where they are, rather than starting from where we think we should be. I also, over the last sort of 2 years really, started exploring the experiences of people who've been in care as a child and what the impact of that is on later life. And I'm care experienced myself, so I was in care from the age of 14. So I bring that within my work professionally, but also into how I view things.
Thank you. Bex?
My name is Rebecca Wright. I go by Bex. I am an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore in America. I worked at St. Christopher's Hospice and I trained at the Florence Nightingale School of Nursing at King's College London. My work has been in palliative care since 2007, and I've spent that time working with the experience-based co-design methodology across 11 or 12 different EBCD projects now. I trained under Dr. Glenn Roberts, and my work has really been around trying to understand how to work with people providing and receiving care in different settings and with different conditions to improve their experiences, with an increasing focus and kind of understanding around equity and inclusion. And then I also come to my work with kind of my own experiences of as a patient and as a caregiver, and then I'll probably tell you more later on.
Thank you both for joining us. My name's Katie Campion and I'm the patient experience program lead at the Point of Care Foundation. I really wanted to gather you both together because there was something in our separate conversations that really struck a chord, which was about the complexity of patient experience and co-design, and how, you know, we don't arrive into interactions, whether we're patients or staff or family members, as blank slates. Particularly Bex, we were talking about race and ethnic diversity, and Howard, when we were talking about the experience people might have had being in care when they were younger. My first question is, in your experience, you know, all of us arrive at interactions, whether we're patients, family members or staff, with a whole dowry of experience and our histories, and all of those bleed into our interactions in healthcare. What impact do you think that has?
So in my research work, the way that I've come to understand experience is through the lens of expectation and understanding. And it's this thing that's been really fascinating. So in EBCD, they talk about touch points, or we talk about touch points, the defining moments that make or break an experience, either positively or negatively. And people will describe having the same encounter, but they experienced it differently. And it's, I think it's sort of at the root as well of kind of where people connect really well or fall out and have arguments and have problems, because there isn't necessarily the awareness between the people involved of what were your expectations of this encounter, of us, of the service, of whatever you thought was going to happen, and what did you understand about it. So as an example, very quickly, in my doctoral work, I was looking at palliative care in the emergency department with older people, and we were trying to understand how did the ED staff, what did they expect of themselves, but what did they think was expected of them? And what did they understand of the needs of the people coming to them? And also, what did they understand about what palliative care was? And then from the patient family side, I was trying to understand, what did you expect of the ED? Why were you going there at this point with these conditions? And what were you expecting could be done? What was your understanding of yourself and your own condition, as well as your understanding? And then within the stories that people shared, we were able to see where positive experiences hung on where those experience, those expectations were met or exceeded. And then the negative ones were, or the negative reports and encounters were more about where expectations were not met, or kind of what was understood was maybe not always accurate on both sides. And so I think those expectations and understandings are informed, like I like that phrasing of the dowry of experiences that you come with. And I think over the course of a lifetime, as well as what you generationally inherit, there is a building up of what you expect and what you understand. And most people don't stop and think about that before they go into a situation or a conversation. We just go through our lives and we don't really realize that that's happened until often we hit a point where the expectation or the understanding is not met. And then the experience goes away we hoped it wouldn't have, I think.
How about for you, Howard?
And I think it's really interesting, I think, what Bex was saying there about that expectation, I think, changes over time. And because of the experiences that we then, as you say, that creation of that dowry over our life, but also then what we're interacting with other people, but also our own understanding about who we are as people and individuals within that interaction. You know, I think maybe what somebody expects out of receiving healthcare earlier on in their life compared to maybe later on is going to significantly change as well. And I think we could really debate as to why that expectation changes, you know, in terms of how we mature as individuals. Is there something around expectation later on in life? Because, you know, again, I sort of hear that, you know, people say, well, I've paid my taxes all my life, you know, and it's something that, you know, certainly from within the UK, people pay their national insurance and therefore it's their right to receive X or Y because I've paid that. You know, I think for me, I think that what's really important in terms of that history and about our personal history as well, I wonder, you know, if we really get that opportunity to be able to unpick what that is for individuals. Do we really have that space and that time to be able to develop those trusting relationships with somebody? And that initial touch point, I love that description because, you know, those touch points are real key, aren't they? And, you know, you can make a relationship and that takes a while to build, but we can also break a relationship by just one word. And I think that, you know, we do as much as we can within healthcare, but, you know, like with the ED description or in urgent care or other services where, you know, potentially it is more of that, you know, more of like a conveyor belt, you know, thinking around day surgery and that real throughput, you know, there's a process that patients go through. And, you know, having that time to be able to develop that relationship and to listen to somebody within that, I think is a real challenge for people and for staff.
I think it's really interesting that you brought up relationships because we know a lot about patient experience data, and we know that what patients and their families routinely say is the most important aspects of care are the relational aspects. So knowing what's going to happen to you, trusting the people that are looking after you. But of course, in terms of patient experience data, the easiest thing to measure is actually the systems and the processes. I wondered if you had any thoughts about things that you've seen in terms of the impact of relationships on care. Again, I'll come to you, Bex, first.
Thank you. I always love listening to Howard because everything he says sparks all my thoughts. I'm like, yes, this too.
Oh, that's good.
There was one of the things you said I think really ties into the answer to this, which was about how one word can break trust. In the research studies that myself and my team have been doing lately, there's a couple that I wanted to kind of use as an example in terms of the impact of that relationship on experience. One of them we worked it was a result of our other projects, actually, and we were working with the environmental and supportive care staff, as they, that's how they call them over in the US here, and so housekeepers and cleaners. And when we were doing research with patients and families, and we were learning about understandings in the emergency department, we were looking at things happening in the ICU, and in a couple we were focusing specifically on experiences of working with Black populations. And we kept hearing about this staffing group and realized we were kind of missing a trick, maybe. And so we did this study called Reimagining the Interdisciplinary Care Team to Address Health Equities, Health Inequities in Palliative Care. And I think I meant to say this, it was funded by the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing Discovery and Innovation Award. And in that work, we were really, really honored to be able to work with the EVC staff at Bayview Medical Center, as a hospital part of Johns Hopkins. And what we found is absolutely fascinating. And it was this piece where I think a lot of the time, healthcare providers like nurses, doctors, and others, we're really focused on our role and our impact. And we don't realize how much we live within the bubble of our interactions and can really easily forget that we are momentary in someone else's experience, because for us, it's our daily job, it's everything. So when we try and find out what was the impact of your experiences, it's always about, what did you think of me? What did you think of how I did? What was this interaction? So in this research using experience-based co-design, we always do narrative interviews. So we don't have a topic guide with patients and families. We say, tell us your story, because then what comes out and where we see these aligning touch points, it really shows us, okay, well, how impactful was what we were focused on compared to what you actually told us? And as I say, we kept hearing about the housekeepers and the cleaners and how impactful they were. And what we found was, for patients with serious life-limiting illnesses who are inpatients for a long period of time, there is a really significant health equity or an inequity that they experience, where their quality of relationship from their perspective goes down with the healthcare team because of things that they've cited, like, I've become a medical problem. And you hear it in the phrasing that we use, they're not responding to treatment. And sometimes our medical jargon is brutal, and we don't realize how that feels to someone who hasn't been trained, like patient denied, patient refused. And you ignore the whole story of, they weren't denying, they weren't refusing, it was impossible for them to do this because of their life, and our system is demanding and are saying, we'll only help you if you do these things. So over time, these patients who are getting sicker because that's the condition that they have, they're often these incurable conditions, there isn't going to be an up trajectory that continues up, it's just going to keep going towards the end of life. But there's still these needs, there's still pain or other symptoms or experiences or pieces that need addressing. And teams, they feel given up on by their teams sometimes. They're being passed from pillar to post, or this ward or that ward, and so on. But with the housekeepers or the cleaners, they're the most consistent staff. They were in every day and they built relationships. And so on that side, the relationship went up. And it was kind of like on a graph, like the quality of relationship just passed each other between staff. It just went down on the healthcare side, and on the clinical care of the housekeepers and cleaners, it went up. Because it was, I think, most beautifully phrased by someone who said, well, there was a couple. One was saying, well, when that person came in, I felt my shoulders relax. I could go out the room and get a cup of tea because I knew that there was someone with my loved one who cared about them. And someone else said it, and it really, really hit me. And they said they reminded them that they were still a human. And we talk a lot, even in kind of the research I do, about seeing the person in the patient, but that's always focused on making sure the healthcare team remember there's a person in the patient. But when you're ill for such a long time, or just being in the healthcare system, you can also forget that you're a person. And so someone who just came in and was like, oh, what are you watching on telly? How's this? How's that? And the patients and families said, like, they became like family to me. And the families said they reassured me as a family member. And so I think what then became really important to that point about trust was that people said, someone walking into my room and ignoring the fact that the cleaner's in there and just starting talking, they lost trust with me in that second. We were having a conversation, and what you let me know is that that person's not important enough. And maybe I do that same job in my own day job. Patients and the EBC staff both described themselves as feeling like they were the bottom of the hierarchy. And they often, I think they've connected on that. So walking into a patient's room and you think, well, I introduced myself, I was pleasant, I was friendly. Yes, but what you did was walk across a pre-existing relationship. You dropped your gloves on the floor. That's that person's home environment. You made a mess of their home. You didn't respect the environment they were in. You didn't respect the conversation that was happening. You prioritized your medical need over their value for the relationships that were around them. And so I think this point of we can break relationships in seconds, and then we go, oh, we can't, they're difficult patient, difficult family, we can't build trust, you know, they don't want to trust us. And it's like, they wanted to. If they came in, there was a desire for trust. What we need to understand is where and how did we unintentionally break that because of not being aware.
Howard, what about for you?
I think that relationship of, you know, the housekeeping staff, as you know, as part of the, should be seen as part of the core team. As you say, you know, I think that those relationships, they're based on no sort of professional criteria or no labelling. Possibly as well, they're going to have more conversations with the patient than maybe the nursing or medical staff or therapists, because that time that they will have will be longer. And often as well is the person that's providing them with their food. So all those real fundamental things that we need as human beings to survive, that is what's being provided. And it's interesting as well, and happy to share in terms of something for myself personally as part of this as well, is that a few years ago, I was going through some court processes for stuff that happened for me in my past. And it was a really stressful time for me. And I was getting some chest pain, you know, potentially linked to anxiety, and was being reviewed by the cardiologist, and was sent over to see the cardiologist, and wanted to do a 24-hour ECG tape where I'd be, you know, obviously wired up and would be monitored over 24 hours. But it was right in the middle of the time when I was going through court process, and it was about things that happened to me physically as a child. And I did not want anybody to be touching me. So the referral came in, the appointment came in for me to go into cardiology and to be wired up and everything. And I declined it because I did not feel that I wanted anybody else touching me. And the phone call then that I received was telling me off. The phone call I had wasn't, oh, just seeing what's the reason why, you know, is everything okay with you? It was phoning me up to say, well, in that case, then if you're not going to come in and have this test, we will discharge you. And that was the end of the conversation. There was no trying to find out the reasons why. It was, no, you're not being compliant, so therefore we're going to discharge you. And for me, that what we're just describing there in terms of those points in time, but also those, you know, what is then that interaction and what is then the result from that? For me, I then completely disengaged because I was feeling almost abused again. Mm. You know, how I'd been spoken to was abusive. It was controlling. And how I respond in that situation then is to withdraw because I then go into protection mode. So that's how I respond. And I come from a, you know, nursing, health visiting, and I'm in a reasonably senior role in the NHS. And that was my response, knowing all of the factors around it and why I needed to have it done. So if I do that and I know the system and how it works, what's the impact for other people?
It's really interesting. It's making me think quite a lot about the, you know, you mentioned earlier, Bex, the kind of hierarchy, and there's definitely something there about power and control. I was interviewing someone a few years ago for an experience-based co-design project, and he was a paramedic, very experienced paramedic, and was going through cancer treatment, but was having very, very severe side effects to the chemotherapy. And he was the main primary carer for his wife who had dementia. And so every Friday evening, he would have this reaction to chemotherapy and be admitted to hospital, and she was left on her own at home. And they'd said that there were kind of 10 sessions which were really important, and the last two were kind of belts and braces, as they put it. So it's like extra. And so he talked to the consultant about whether that would be, given that he's weighing up looking after his wife at home with the chemotherapy treatment. He had a conversation with his consultant, and he decided, and it felt like quite a collaborative conversation, he decided that he wasn't going to have those last two rounds of chemotherapy. But he noticed later in his notes that had been written that he had refused treatment. And as a paramedic, he was really concerned that that would act against him further down the line, that if he went back into hospital and someone read that in his notes, that actually that might influence their thinking about the treatment that he should be offered. So what I'm curious about now is thinking about where this comes from. So thinking about control, different agendas, you know, it seems like the medical team are kind of focused on a patient and the particular kind of medical thing going on. And from what you were saying, Bex, that really influences those relationships. Where do you think that comes from? Where does that stem from?
I think if we're going to go full on philosophical, I think is to paraphrase Beauty and the Beast, it's a tale as old as time. I think as long as you've had people, you've had control. You know, as long as there've been two people in a room together, there's a dynamic that's going to be formed. And I think many people have their own agendas. People want to get things done. And I think it speaks to histories that cover all of the things that we see happening today, like misogyny, paternalism, sexism, racism, classism. I don't think that humility is actually an intuitive sense for most people, honestly. There are people I've met who it is, it's just in there. But the majority of people, myself included, we believe our own thoughts very strongly. And it takes a lot of experiences and listening and a desire to listen to realize that our thoughts are but one in an ocean. And I recently on X, or as was Twitter, I sort of put this comment out where I said, the more time I spend listening to people, the more I want to come with a sign that says all opinions subject to change. Because the more I listen to people, the more I realize, like, I got that wrong. I didn't understand that fully. There's more of your perspective than I didn't realize. And I think about how I want to always be thought the best of. Like, why would you not assume my best intentions? But wait, why am I not assuming your best intentions? And I think from the healthcare side, many of those isms are inbuilt into the structure of it. And some very, very deliberately. And I think if you look back at healthcare in the UK, the dismissal of, like, the village woman who used to be the person who had the herbs and spices and be like, witch, as opposed to like, yeah, oh, wow, you really know your garden. That's really helpful. Like old wives' tales. Like some of those things aren't tales and some of those old wives are super wise. And it's interesting, actually, in the UK, in some of my research, I saw real strains of classism coming into play in terms of how much people would be listened to or not based on their accent. And I see it reflected more in racism, I think, in some of my work, or experiences of how people are being treated and kind of, I have to go in angry or you won't listen. Like, if I don't make a noise, if I'm not shouting, you won't just see me and understand my pain and realize that I've come out here because I needed help. I'm going to have to be a problem to receive the help, and then my experience of care is going to be dire, but at least we got what we needed. And I've heard people on both sides of the pond saying almost word for word that, like, I knew I had to go in angry, but that's not who I am. And I think that we do a disservice to our healthcare providers in the way that you have to have a degree of confidence to be a healthcare professional, to go in. But there isn't a good balance in our training between the confidence, because you're making decisions sometimes on people's behalf because they can't and there's no one else there and you have to make the call. But what we don't often talk about is the degree of arrogance that makes us think we have any right to go into someone's life and do that. That, of course, I know what's better for you. And when there was a theme in one of our studies, it was about palliative care in the ICU with Black populations, and it was a conflict between spirituality and hope versus medical futility. If your wishes and your desire conflate and go against that, no, no, we're done here. That's how it can come across, and it becomes a conflict because we don't train people on how to manage opposing worldviews. We sort of have this thing that the medical worldview is the correct worldview. So you need to come align. There is this thing of kind of, if patients aren't compliant, which is another word I despise in this setting, you know, if patients aren't X, Y, Z, and it's this thing of like, okay, these are just people and it's their life and their choice. They don't have to make sensible choices. And I'm always saying to my students, you don't have to do a show of hands, but how many of you make well-informed, terrible decisions every day for your life and your health? How many of you are just eating healthily, just living healthily, just having really healthy, productive relationships? How many of you are making bad choices because you're too tired, you don't have resources, you feel you have to? We judge people when they do that in healthcare for things that we do all the time. The amazing honor of the professions that we have gets sometimes conflated with an arrogance and a self-righteousness, if I'm being really honest, of like, well, of course I know best. And I think it's really hard to have a balance of the right confidence to help people make life-changing decisions and a humility, because it's like, well, what if I'm wrong? I can't think what if I'm wrong, because I have to think what if I'm right. But there has to be another balance between that. And that's, I know, where like shared decision making comes in. But even stuff when people talk about patient-centered care, I just feel like quite often that patient's on their own in the middle with like just people circling them. It doesn't mean they're part of it or included. Like, you know, the research that showed doctors tend to interrupt patients after about 18 seconds of them speaking. And a lot of the healthcare training or communication starts with it's changing, but has often started with, here's the medical perspective, now what do you want, rather than who are you? Yeah. And I've started asking this question to people where I say, tell me who you are, like what mattered to you about who you are before you ever came into contact with the healthcare profession. Now tell me who you are when you came into contact, what changed, what stayed the same? And so often we enforce demographics and we weed out humanity. And like, I became my age, my color, my class, my education level, and I stopped being the daughter, the mom, the artist, the person of compassion. Like, what I've loved and valued was just weeded out and out and out to these check boxes.
We were just saying there about that, I say, certainly like the language that we use, and what happens, doesn't it, is that, you know, a patient will be admitted, and then what we do is we do an assessment. So we're going to assess them, which again, that word that we use around assessment in terms of an exam, you know, we'll do an examination, you know, it's all things that we've got control on. So straight away, what we do right from the beginning is saying, I know best, I'm going to assess you against what I think my knowledge is and what our protocols say. And that's completely the wrong way around. You know, we've all worked in healthcare for a number of years. And I think some of the interactions that sort of I've had when I was working clinically, both nursing and health visiting, is that those relationships and how I created those relationships, which is why when I went into health visiting, I wanted to be part of somebody's life. And I've always been very community focused. I did my nurse training in an acute trust, and I knew straight away I wanted to be out in the community. And the reason was because I wanted to be a guest in somebody else's home rather than somebody being a guest in a hospital. Because those relationship dynamics, understanding the person, and still those dynamics are still there, but you really see the person more because you see them in their own home, in their environment, and can really understand the whole situation. Not completely, but you've got more of a chance to be able to. And I always have described that in terms of that description between community and working in a hospital being, you know, I'm a guest in somebody's home. And for me, that whole power and that control, that changes that straight away. And there's some things I think that I've done when I've been, certainly when I was health visiting, where actually where I started from was, what was the need of that person? And I worked there first. There were things that I needed to encourage or steer within a family, but where I started from was first from that person. What was their need? How did I build that trust first and then build from there? Because you have to, you know, you've got to do that.
I think there's one other aspect of relational that I think is really, really important. And it was something I learned through this study working with Black families and patients. In every EBCD study I've done, seeing the person and the patient has come out as a theme. Every single time it's come out. And in this one, it was different, and it was meeting the person in the patient. And when it comes to relationship, the pushback I get from staff a lot of the time is the amount of time they don't have. And like, when they hear the word relationship, and I'm sure I would have as well, but prior to this work, thought, I don't have time or capacity to build this intense relationship with someone. And that is not what anyone's talking about. And I think I just kind of wanted to define what I mean when I'm talking about relationship. With the people I spoke to in this study in the US, and they've signed off, they've validated, and they've given me permission to share, it's that their experiences in the healthcare system in America, where racism is kind of written into the infrastructure in so many ways, is that relationship was the difference between a lifeline or a life sentence. And the majority of people who spoke with me shared that they nearly died on countless occasions because they were dismissed. You know, they'd gone in, they knew they weren't okay, they knew their bodies, and they were told they weren't given the full assessments, they weren't given the proper scans, or they were told come back if it gets worse, etc., etc. And when they were helped, it was because someone connected with them. And so the point of relationship isn't that, like, you're going to go home and have dinner with them and, like, pressure, like, they want to exchange Christmas cards. It was this thing of, you have connected with me somehow to a point that I feel that you see me, I feel that you are listening to me, and I feel like my priorities have been taken into consideration by you. And this could literally happen within seconds of the encounter. And that's what I mean. Like, this isn't about, I don't have time. In this ED study that I did in the UK, there was a caregiver who said, was talking about how the resus department was so much more helpful than the majors department, even though it's the same hospital, same unit, same staff. And one of the staff on the docs were saying, well, you know, it's so busy in the majors area. There's, you know, the ratio of patients to docs and nurses is much bigger, whereas in resus, it's more 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. And the caregiver replied, and it's genuinely one of the only times I've seen a, like, sudden silence, mic drop moment. She said, are you telling me you don't have time to put your hand on my shoulder and say, hang in there as you walk past? And that was what she meant by relationship. And there was no answer, because what is the answer? Like, of course you have time to make eye. I mean, and I understand people don't want to make eye contact sometimes because they're thinking, you're going to give me something else to do and I'm already so behind and there's so much and there's so few of us and so many of you. But the connection I keep hearing, and I felt for myself when I was a patient as well, it was just acknowledge that you recognize I'm in here. I'm not going to ask you for something. Yeah. But that was relationship. And that, as I say, for certain groups, I think from different racial backgrounds, from different class backgrounds, I think I'm on the spectrum my own self, this may have come across already, but I think people who don't feel that they fit within the systems, that relationship is a lifeline or a life sentence, sometimes literally. And that's why I think it matters so much. So for people who aren't on that, we might go away and say, that wasn't a great experience, that was disappointing, but they're less likely to go away and go, oh, we're going to die. If we stay here, we're going to be in such serious trouble. We know it's going to get worse. And I think that's, if you make a connection, and interestingly, it wasn't that the connection always had to be with another person who themselves were Black. If it was someone they felt a connection, and they would follow that person wherever they went, if they felt safe with them. And that's what relationship is giving. And I don't know how often clinicians remember that. It's not, I felt good with you. It's that I felt safe with you. And when you're a patient, you're so vulnerable. That safety can help you heal, I think, because you can relax, which means all the treatments and stuff can start to work in a different way than if you're like, oh God, I can't leave my family member in case something happens when I'm gone, or I cannot sleep because I'm afraid of what you're going to do when I'm asleep. And, like, I've heard those stories. So sorry, I'm so sorry, I can't do short, but that was
perfect.
Thank you very much.
It's really interesting because one of the things that we hear quite often on our courses is that patient experience or the relational stuff is kind of the icing on the cake. Like, it'd be really nice to do, but it's not critical, it's not essential. But we know that the three pillars of quality are clinical effectiveness, safety, and patient experience. So I'm really interested that that theme of safety is coming through from that relationship or lack of relationship. Howard, any thoughts about that? About the kind of safety bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think you really nailed it there. I mean, I think that that patient experience, as you say, I think we often think patient experience occurs once we're getting feedback because of something that we've done, rather than really thinking about how are we engaging with a person to ensure that that patient experience, we've made that link and that connection, as Bex has been describing. And I think as well, what Bex was talking about in terms of the research earlier as well, about that relationship with the housekeeping staff, that really resonates, I think, with that connection, isn't it? That real focus at the moment around patient safety is about learning. What can we learn from an event that's happened, you know, from an incident that's happened, but also learning from where things have gone well as well. So really shifting that focus. Let's focus on, gosh, we get things right most of the time. How can we learn from that and spread that? but linking that with the patient experience and ensuring that we're listening to the patient voice to really hear what patients are telling us and telling those stories. But I think we need to create an environment that's feeling safe for staff to listen and for organisations to feel safe as well. And being brave, you know, the whole point around experience-based co-design, you know, really being brave and just opening our minds and our ears and listening to what people are saying to us and recognising that that it could feel slightly uncomfortable. It might be something that doesn't fit with what we think we're going to hear, you know, it's going to be different. And certainly I think from some of the work that I've started to be doing, listening to people who are care experienced, who are in care as a child and their experiences now of adults as an adult and having received healthcare during their life is an area that we haven't explored, I don't think, at all. We're starting to think more about the impact of trauma and how does trauma impact on healthcare. But certainly from a care experience perspective, so, you know, people who are in care as a child, you know, we're not routinely asking that. And it's not a protected characteristic at the moment within the UK. It is in some local authorities, but not across and certainly not in the NHS. So people are coming in and are experiencing healthcare, but have got that trauma and potentially multiple adverse childhood experiences. And we don't understand what that is. Well, how can we in the NHS then support? So examples can be, you know, asking people who, you know, who might not know their family history and asking somebody for their family medical history, or people who are coming into healthcare, into, you know, to receiving healthcare, into an environment that to them reflects children's home. And we don't think about that. So for me, I think, you know, raising awareness of, you know, seeing all this, the diversity that Bex was calling about, but really being open to listening to what people are sharing from their personal stories, making those connections and making sure that people are feeling safe so that people can then share with us what they want to. But that initial connection, making sure that somebody is safe, building that relationship, as Bex has, you know, really well described there. It isn't about sitting down with somebody for an hour and listening to somebody's whole life story. It is about that, those real simple human gestures, putting our hand on somebody's shoulder if they're okay with that, that eye contact. Is what we need, as that was that real fundamental, isn't it? And we get it. We get that right so many times, but when we don't, it can be devastating.
Really interesting. And kind of brought me round to my last question, which is, given all of the challenges that we've talked about, what are the things that we can do? What are the small things that can help? Bex, do you want to add anything to what Had was saying?
I reckon that part of what we can do is add a bit of realism into it, because I think often people come into healthcare, I want to help everyone, or I want to change everything. And I often question people when I have students who say, I want to change things. I'm like, that's great. Why do you think we should trust what you think over anyone else? Like, that's terrifying confidence in my mind. And I'm not saying you're wrong. I just want to know where that's come from and why. And I think often people, there is so much that is terrible everywhere that it feels overwhelming. And I think the default can be we either change everything for brilliant immediately or we give up and everything sucks forever. And my little bit of realism would be, all right, in my own work and in my own day, can I at least just make sure that my interactions with people to the best of my ability and knowledge leave them feeling a bit better than before we came into contact in that day? Given what we know about relationship and how important it is, and there was a theme in one of the finding pieces or touch points in my work, one of my recent studies was the way you do what you do is as important as what you do. And I think if we just remembered that, the way I'm doing it is having an impact just as much as what I'm doing. And that sometimes if the way I do it is callous or heartless or misses the person, the what that I did is irrelevant and won't work. Am I aware of how I'm doing what I'm doing? Mm. And do I ever even ask for feedback on the how, you know, from the people who had it? And do I honestly want to hear it? Like, am I willing to hear that could have been kinder? oh, that didn't help. And I think, Howard, you made a really important point that I think comes through in my work as well, which is how much care and support staff need to, because we live with it as well and become the second level victims and build up like the trauma that we see and the stories that we hear, and that makes you brittle. So if we, this one team I work with at Bayview, they have a thing called Thrive by Design, where their clinical team just engage with arts and crafts and loads of different mechanisms and music, and to just invest in themselves as people to have that opportunity to process what they're processing. And I think, look after the staff, make sure they're okay. And then for staff, are you looking at how you're doing what you're doing?
I think there's a couple of things that I've sort of got in my head, of things that I've had shared with me in the past, which I think sort of sum up. And they're sort of phrases that I often use. And one of those was from a leadership program that I did, which links with leadership, but also in terms of how we think about relationships with anybody. And that was a really simple question, which is, what was it like being on the receiving end of me? And for me, that's a really powerful question to ask, I think, in any relationship. You know, what was it like being on the receiving end of me, both in terms of how that person experienced me, but actually, did that person really experience me? Did I really share part of myself with that relationship? And I think really good way just to sort of finish with that, really, because for me, that's I don't know, of all of the leadership things I've done, that's the one thing that has really always struck with me, because it's a really good question to ask, a hard one. And sometimes, as you'd said a minute ago, Bex, that I sometimes ask myself that question and actually I'm ashamed sometimes, because, you know, actually I know that I haven't been the best that I could have for that person. But it's then that gives me time and space to think, well, actually, there was lots of other things that were happening, and how I came into that conversation with somebody. I wasn't in the right, you know, right frame of mind because something else had happened. And therefore, you know, there was other processes or there's other factors that affected me, but just enables me to take that time out.
Thank you both so much. It's always an absolute privilege to speak to both of you. We will wrap it up there, if that's okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Humanising Health and Care podcast. To find out more about our experience-based co-design courses and our Experiences of Care programme, please visit our website at pointofcarefoundation.org.uk. Thank you.